on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And today, one Tasmanian wool grower predicts a rise in price for wool next year.
I've got a bit of a belief that I hear everyone whinging about merinos. I say, well, get out of them, because I'll have them. And I mean, that's only going to push the price up because there's going to be less wool around and there'll be still a good demand for it.
And the cattle collars lighting up for the Christmas period.
When would you like the festive lights on? So you can select, you know, in 15 minutes or in an hour or whatever you want. Select that and then the timer counts down and then you go down the paddock and the paddock goes dark. Yeah, flashing lights and it plays, I think it's Jingle Bells through the app. So you can hear it on the app, but they can't hear it on the collars. Their collars are just flashing. So the whole paddock looks like it's got, yeah, Christmas lights scattered throughout. It's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool. The virtual fencing collars proving a Christmas treat for the cows and their owners. That story coming up today. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this final day of 2025. All the best to you and your family for the new year. Virtual fencing has been around for a while in Tasmania, but other states are catching up and enjoying the coloured lights at night. Today we take you to a couple of the mainland states where beef farmers have taken on the challenge of virtual fencing, and it seems to be working well. We'll also hear from one Tasmanian wool producer who's confident the wool price will rise next year. His advice for merino producers who are not happy with the wool market is also given. And we look back on the dairy industry in the state during the year and how farmers cope with that rather strange weather through spring. As usual, we'll check the weather in around 10 minutes from now. We'll take your thoughts via the text line 0438 922 936, that number. First up, feral cats and foxes are two of the worst invasive species across the country, costing the agriculture sector more than $198 million a year in losses and control costs. The Centre for Invasive Species Solution has welcomed a new National Feral Cat and Fox Management Coordinator to sit alongside the coordinators for rabbits and wild dogs. Yasmin Ali is a couple of weeks into the job and will push for management and eradication where possible. However, this is an ongoing issue which dates back to colonialism.
Well, they were both introduced. They've been here for a long time. They were introduced with European colonisation. Cats were intentionally released to help with the control of rabbits and rodents. And for foxes, they were introduced for the sport of hunting. Both species spread rapidly and now cover so much of Australia. So there's about 99% coverage for feral cats, and they are also on our offshore islands. And for foxes, it's about 80%. So they're not in the tropical north of Australia. And they do really well because they have so few natural predators. So, you know, really in terms of their opportunity for hunting and managing themselves, you know, their threat is really around wildlife, ag industry and our own human health. And they repopulate really quickly. So cats, you know, they can have a number of litters per year when conditions are good. So their populations will grow really quickly in areas where there's, you know, a good environment. And the same can be said for foxes. They tend to breed once a year, but still they spread and they can adapt and live in such a wide variety of habitats. So they are able to spread and live and thrive in so many different places across the country.
You know, a lot of primary producers listening will be familiar with the impact of foxes. You know, they can, you know, devastate livestock, cause a lot of issues. But something I never really thought about is also, I guess, with foxes and maybe and cats as well, is the spreading of certain diseases.
We know that they're both the most damaging invasive species to ag and wildlife, not only through predation competition, but as you've mentioned, through spread of disease. They really, have the ability to transmit diseases such as hydatids, distemper, parvovirus and mange. They also spread weeds and damage infrastructure. And with cats, they can also spread toxoplasmosis. So, you know, those sorts of spreading of diseases into livestock mean that we see aborting of livestock young. It can really impact reproduction and productivity rates in agricultural settings. So it's not only the sort of physical disturbance they cause, but that spreading of disease is of real concern.
They're not great news when you paint the picture like that. What are some of the best control methods that we have for these animals?
Well, I think, you know, we have a lot of underpinning situations where we look at a specific environment and think, well, this is what we can do here. But I think sort of stepping back, probably the best approach we can always look at is taking something that's coordinated and collaborative as far as possible. So working with our neighbours, working within our communities to deliver a consolidated program that's targeted at the right time. And that might be for foxes in spring with lambing, you know, towards the end of winter to address the impacts of, you know, fox populations in those areas. So it's about thinking about your timing, thinking about who else you can do it with, and then what are the tools that we need to use to have the best effect. And often, you know, control measures, you know, using as many tools as possible will give you the best outcomes. So baiting, trapping, shooting, exclusion fencing, guardian animals are fantastic as well for things like chickens and ducks, and also for lambs. They can be a really effective means of control. And, you know, thinking about how and the timing of when you do that work to make sure that you're getting the best outcomes but also the best value for your money in the work that's happening at the time.
I guess this is a big picture question, but left unchecked, what damage could foxes and feral cats do?
It's pretty unlimited. And that given how far they've spread across the country, there's really no limit. And the thing with it is that they're recognised as one of the worst invasive alien species worldwide. They're both in that top 100, which is not a place that, you know, we want them to be. And I think, you know, our focus needs to be around where we can achieve eradication, and that might be in situations like offshore islands or island habitats where we can achieve, you know, localised control and reducing their impacts, whether that's an agricultural impact or an impact on threatened species, and where we can just sustain the control to just try and keep their population down as low as possible, because we know their impacts on our wildlife is so significant. You know, birds and our mammals, you know, they're responsible for so many extinctions in our country. We know that, you know, left unchecked, that number will only increase. So, you know, we don't want them to continue roaming vast distances and preying on all of our reptiles, birds, frogs and mammals, but also not preying on our livestock industry and impacting our agricultural environments as well.
What has been your previous experience working with invasive species before this role?
I worked for Parks Vic, and I've worked for Parks Tasmania as well. So working in the invasive species space for state government, I spent 20 years in Victoria delivering fox, cat programs, goats, pigs, rabbits and pest plant control programs. That, you know, starting out as a ranger at a localised scale in my park to sort of protect birds in a wetland, to then, you know, working towards more broad scale programs as I progressed in my career, delivering landscape scale programs across eastern Victoria, you know, often in response to bushfire or flood as well. So it's something I enjoy, and it can really be a rewarding experience when you reach a point of reducing densities where you start to see our native mammals or birds returning to a site where they have been previously been predated by foxes or cats. It's a really nice outcome. So I do enjoy it. It sounds a bit weird, but I do.
Yeah, it sounds like you know a few things about invasive species and some of these feral animals.
Yeah.
Yasmin, I guess for people listening, is there any message or anything that you hope people can take away when it comes to sort of managing invasive species like foxes and cats?
I think it's about having that awareness of where they are, and if you do see something unusual, if you're in a town or you're seeing more foxes in an area, reporting those. You know, we have really great citizen science tools on the PestSmart website, things like FeralScan, an app you can download to your phone and report in sightings that you know, in an unusual location where you might not have seen a fox or a cat before. So that's really a great way for us to build our knowledge of where the impacts are increasing or decreasing nationally. And I think also considering and thinking about if you are going to be running a program, who are your partners? Who can you work with? Obviously, there are your neighbours, but who else a little further afield can be part of the program and help you to deliver more far-reaching outcomes? And looking at those opportunities for building collaboration and coordinated approaches to have those most positive outcomes on ground.
That's Yasmin Ali, the new National Feral Cat and Fox Management Coordinator with the Centre for Invasive Species Solutions, which is funded by the Department of Agriculture, speaking there to Annie Brown at least. I know she didn't say there weren't any foxes in Tasmania, but we won't go there. Ted on the text line says, Tony, any chance we can get a coordinator to handle that other introduced pest, blackberries, spending a lot of time and money spraying them now? They're all flowering now, Ted. They'll be fruiting early in the new year, the blackberries, yeah, an invasive species as well. Okay, let's check the latest on the weather now. Ursula Connor from the Bureau, g'day.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Doesn't look too bad out there. It's looking quite okay. Any rainfall about anywhere?
Pretty mild day out there today. Nothing in the gauges since 9 a.m. this morning. We did have a little bit pick up sort of yesterday evening with that front that passed over largely through the southeastern parts of the state. We saw around sort of 2 to 5 millimetres. Hobart itself picked up a couple of millimetres. The highest through that area was 7 millimetres at Tea Tree and a couple of millimetres up through the northeast as well. Mount Victoria and Little Forest are picking up a millimetre or two there as well. And, of course, through the west, they saw similar totals as well. But, yes, today has been quite a fine day. We've got a ridge of high pressure slowly pushing in over the state. So that is driving these slightly cooler than average sort of southerly winds, but largely just bringing a little bit of cloud through parts today, Tony. Not too much in the way of rainfall at all.
Now, I had a look at our records. The yearly total rainfall here at the ABC Hobart Studios, a touch over 471 mils if it doesn't rain till midnight tonight. 471 mils. So it's pretty dry, isn't it?
It is a little bit drier than average, yes. We haven't quite, especially through the sort of southeastern, eastern parts of the state, we haven't quite picked up our yearly average in the way of rainfall, no.
No, people think it's pretty wet in Tasmania, but it's not quite wet at all, just sometimes. Now, what can we expect heading into New Year's Eve and New Year's Day?
Yeah, well, overnight tonight, not expecting anything in the way of rainfall still. Could be a little bit of scattered cloud around, but there will be breaks in it. It might be a little bit chilly, minimums overnight tonight. Sort of at the time of the fireworks, we're looking at most of the major centres between sort of 8 and 10 degrees, and with those southerly winds, it might feel a little bit chilly. So might be worth throwing on a jacket tonight if you're out watching the fireworks. But as we move into the rest of the week, we're largely looking at fairly settled conditions through sort of tomorrow and Friday as this high-pressure system makes its way over the state. We could just see some very light showers, mainly about the southwest tomorrow and then potentially about eastern parts on Friday. But we're really not looking at much more than a millimetre or maybe two if you do see one of those showers near you. The winds will start to settle down as well as we see that high-pressure system moving in over us. And then as we move into the weekend, a bit of a trough pushes over the state on Saturday. Still only looks like it'll bring a shower or two with a couple of millimetres, mainly through central and maybe just reaching the southern parts. And then on Sunday, it looks like that trough's just going to linger off the east coast. So that could bring a little bit more easterly wind to push a few showers onshore about mainly the east coast. So we could see a couple millimetres pick up through there, most likely about the northeast ranges where we see a bit of topography. Could even see a rumble of thunder and a couple more millimetres through there. But we're largely looking at settled conditions, Tony, as we move through the rest of this week and even into next week as well. The temperatures will be starting to warm up as we get closer to the weekend and into early next week, a little bit more northerly wind around.
Now, do we have any warnings, Ursula?
Just the one warning at the moment, and that is a strong wind warning for the far northwest coast.
And for the people on the waters, coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, we're looking at south to southwesterly winds around 15 to 25 knots today, sort of variable below 15 knots about the central north, and then with sort of some inshore sea breezes picking up. And then as we move into tomorrow, we'll see the south southwesterlies continuing at around sort of 10 to 20 knots, maybe a little bit stronger through the south in the morning, and then those afternoon inshore sea breezes again. In the swell through the west and south, we are looking at a west to southwesterly of 2 to 2.5 metres. In the north, a westerly around 1 metre. And in the east, an easterly around 1 to 1.5 metres and a southerly around 1 metre. Cape Sorrel currently sitting at that southwesterly swell at 2.3 metres, maximum wave height at 3.9 metres. Mariah Island, a dead southerly swell peaking there at 1.5 metres, max wave height at 2.2.
Good on you, Ursula. You have a great new year. Thank you.
Cheers, Tony. Happy New Year.
Ursula Connor there from the Bureau with the latest information for you on the Country Hour. We'll talk about the dairy industry in just a moment.
Evenings are so loud.
With Helen Shields.
You'll be entertained.
Turn it into a song about a Tasmanian town.
Am I ever going to Swansea your face again?
Evenings with Helen.
Get on with it.
Returning in 2026 on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, between wild weather, massive electricity bills and high input costs, dairy has been a challenge for Tasmanian farmers in the past 12 months. But on the positive side, milk production is stable, sentiment pretty good, and that's compared to elsewhere in the country. And that's according to Liz Mann, Dairy Australia Extension Lead Team for South Australia, Tasmania and WA, who spoke to Meg Ferguson.
Well, as you know, Meg, it's been rather up and down. So, yeah, like if we look back, it was kind of quite a dry start end, in inverted commas, to the dairy season with such a late autumn break that really sort of didn't come, and then led to quite a reasonable calving because we actually had a little bit of feed on hand and cows are in better condition than the year before. But yeah, this spring's been late and it's been cold and it's been windy, and so, you know, we've still got farmers that were cutting hay and silage and that sort of stuff, but at least we've got the feed. So I think the season's finishing, well, we're finishing our calendar year quite reasonable.
And the prices this half of the year anyway, how have they been for farmers? I know they always want more, obviously. They've been higher for a couple of years, but costs have been so up there, of course.
Yeah, exactly right, Meg. And look, they have been strong. Prices have been strong for quite a few years now. But as you say, cost of production has really put quite a lot of pressure on the dry end to the dairy season. So, you know, the March, April, May, June sort of period really put a lot of pressure on. And then coming into this year, we've got really good prices and the feed prices coming off a little bit, but there's still a fair bit of pressure on that. That's sort of putting a little bit of pressure on profitability of farms.
What's the general sentiment out there from dairy farmers in Tasmania?
Look, I think the sentiment's been overall is good. Tassie has really positive farmers in general. And so, it hasn't been an easy year to navigate in terms of seasonality and feeds and the like and costs, as we've just mentioned. But generally, I think farmers are quite comfortable and generally quite happy.
And have there been any really big challenges for farmers this year, Liz?
Look, it's just the ongoing challenges that we tend to have. So staffing tends to be one of the regular ones that we hear about within Dairy Australia. You know, we're always on the hunt within the dairy industry for anyone who's good and keen and willing to have a go. But input costs and seasonal conditions have been challenging as always, but, you know, wouldn't be farming if we didn't have them.
Yeah, same answer every year in every industry, shockingly.
I know, exactly right.
On a more positive note, have there been any sort of success stories this year that stick out in your mind or wins for the industry?
Oh, that one's challenging because you always sort of try and figure out, you know, what's been big standout. And I don't know if there's been any really big standouts for the year, but what we're seeing is people still willing to invest in the industry in Tasmania, which is just awesome. You know, we're still continuing, like milk production is stable, so we're probably sitting about where we were for last year. Which is nice. For me, that is a win. We're not going backwards. We're holding our own.
And how does that compare to the rest of the country? There's been a bit of a decline elsewhere.
Yeah. Look, nationally, milk production is back. I think November is sitting back at about minus 2%, roughly. But, yeah, if we look across, you know, some of the other regions, particularly South Australia and Western Victoria, have had a pretty rough old year. Parts of those regions are only just even starting to get their head above water. So, you know, I've seen quite a few people exiting, you know, huge expenses in those regions. But, yeah, then we've had other regions. I think Queensland's had quite a good year. So, yeah, it's sort of across the board. There's ups and downs everywhere.
Speaking of ups and downs, there's been a bit of movement from dairy companies. So we saw the sale of King Island from Saputo. We saw Fonterra selling its assets to Lactalis. Well, and of course, King Island, I should mention, was rescued by a smaller kind of boutique operation. Liz, is dairy still a viable business in Australia?
Oh, 100%. Definitely still viable. And look, I'll put my Tassie glasses on and my Tassie bias on, and it's so viable in Tasmania. Like, we're often very profitable. And I think that investment by the guys into King Island, like, that's probably one of the bigger wins. It was awesome to see that happen. But, you know, that investment into our industry, I think's really such a backing of how viable our industry is and will be going into the future, definitely.
Liz Mann from Dairy Australia talking to Meg Ferguson about the dairy industry this year. Well, it's been a hard year for many wool-growing districts, especially those hammered by drought on the mainland. For Anthony Gunn in the northern Midlands of Tasmania, the season's been much kinder, especially in the second half of the year.
We're just a family farm on 2,000 hectares at Epping Forest, and we've got a 70% merinos and the rest are crossbreds, and we have a couple of hundred cows as well.
Have you always had sheep here?
Always had sheep, always merinos, and we have got a few first cross ewes now, but they've been around for the last 10 years, I suppose. I'm a passionate wool person, and it's always been around 18, 19 micron we've tried, and we've changed from Hornies to poles now because they seem to be a bit more easy care and more modern merino that we're looking for, trying to breed now.
So how would you sum up 2025?
Well, every year's different. It was very dry earlier on. I think it was the first 3 months of the year was the driest on record here, and we've got records for over 100 years. And then we sort of had to feed right through till July and then to lambing time, and then I thought it was going to be just an average spring because we sort of had enough, and then it sort of just went berserk. And we've had a really good spring now, and all the sheep are looking unbelievable. Like, we've been weighing lambs and weaning lambs, and their weights are really good. And we didn't have a good lambing percent, not what we should have had, but that was mainly due to the weather, I think.
A bit cooler?
Well, it was fairly wet and it was really windy and cold when we lambed, and we're in fairly exposed paddocks because we haven't got enough shelter in everywhere, and I think that was the main reason. But it was quite reasonable still. I mean, every year's different. We've cut more and beyond. We've just cut paddocks for the sake of cutting them to store it, just to tidy it up. We just haven't got enough cattle for a short time. But that's fine.
It's a good problem to have.
I'm not complaining.
What's been your strategy this year for selling wool?
This year, usually I just used to sell it all in July, but this year, as the market's been rising, I've just been selling little bits and pieces for the last 6 months, and it's gone pretty. I'm pretty happy with how it's all sold, and the prices are heading in the right direction. Yeah, and looking forward to the next clip.
Compared to having this conversation 12 months ago, it has perhaps not been as a bumpy a ride as it was last year for the wool market.
No, it definitely hasn't. It's been on the right way, heading in the right direction. And, I mean, we're trying to breed sheep a bit of dual purpose as well with the meat as well now. So, I mean, it's all, and the meat prices are very good at the moment too.
What's your approach there for selling sheep?
Well, we just try to just make sure to put as much weight on them as possible. Like our merino weather lambs will sell off. And try to put them, we probably might get away a bit earlier this year because we'll shear them and then fatten them under the pivots and sell them, and could be 3 or 4 months in front of last year. We kept all of our numbers last year. We made the policy that we're going to keep all our breeding stock and just feed. It's paid off because we haven't got enough now, but that's a good problem to have. But we'll just keep numbers around the same. We're trying to breed a modern merino because we haven't mulesed here for 5 or 6 years, and it's all going really well, and we don't have any issues with it that can't be managed with the fly strike issues. And I mean, the big thing is you've just got to get used to seeing sheep with stain and dag on them, and once you get your head around that, it's not an issue.
Is there a premium for providing non-mules wool into the market?
Well, we're RWS as well, and I'd definitely say that we're seeing a premium from it. I think some think they've got a mules, or they're probably not breeding the right type of sheep.
It's a generational thing, do you think?
Probably, yeah, totally. I mean, I'm 63 and I don't have an issue with the unmuled sheep at all. We do cull fairly heavily if we see anything that's not the sort of modern-day sheep that we're trying to breed. We'll get rid of a lot of those, but we still don't have any trouble with numbers now. And it's getting easier and easier every year. We see them just coming, as soon as we've got them in the classing race, you can see them. They're really improving.
What are your hopes for the next season?
Well, I think it's heading north because I've got a bit of a belief that I hear everyone whinging about merinos. I say, well, get out of them. Because I'll have them. And, I mean, that's only going to push the price up because there's going to be less wool around and there'll be still a good demand for it.
Yeah, good way of looking at it, isn't it? Anthony Gunn from the property Fortin at Epping Forest in the Northern Midlands chatting to Larissa Smith about the prospects for the wool industry next year. Now, it was trialled in Tasmania, virtual fencing with dairy cattle. It's now moved into other states involving beef cattle. Those stories coming up for you, and eating offal might be good for the new year plate. We'll talk about that as well. First up, the news headlines with Josh Duggan.
Good afternoon, Tony, and hold the offal for me if you can. New South Wales yacht Min River is now the overall winner of this year's Sydney Hobart Yacht Race after a protest was upheld against New Caledonian-flagged BNC. On Tuesday, the crew of double-handed entry Min River claimed BNC breached a technical rule governing how a sail can be fixed to the boat. Race Committee Chair Lee Goddard says it wasn't a deliberate breach, but BNC has been given a penalty of 1 hour and 5 minutes, meaning it drops down to second. Zhang Li is the first female skipper to win the overall, and Min River is the first double-handed yacht to win. The US ambassador to NATO says it's unclear if Ukraine attacked the home of the Russian president. Moscow has accused Kyiv of launching dozens of drones towards the residence of Vladimir Putin earlier this week. Ukraine insists that's not the case and accuses Russia of trying to derail progress made in peace talks with the US. And residents in Dolphin Sands on Tasmania's east coast say they've been targeted by looters just weeks after a bushfire which destroyed 19 homes. A few residents have posted to social media saying items seem to have been taken from their properties, while another resident noticed someone looking through the rubble of a burnt-down house. Resident Paul Walker went to Hobart 2 days ago and returned home to find the panel of a log burner and 2 jerry cans of diesel were gone. He says some of his neighbours have lost sentimental items and they've been through enough already. More news at 1.
Josh, before you go, I've just got to investigate that further. You want the offal.
I'm okay without it. I'll give you.
Without it?
I'm okay.
You sure?
Yep, absolutely.
Don't like the liver?
No, I was a picky eater when I was a kid, so I've gotten a lot better. I'm pretty outgoing now, but some things remain.
If it's cooked well, it is great.
I'll take your word for it.
Have a great new year. Thanks, Josh.
You too.
Josh Duggan there with the news. Now, coming up in just a moment, we'll talk virtual fencing and shortly we'll look at the offal. Call it awful, some people.
Join the ultimate party this New Year's Eve across the ABC with a massive lineup, including Melanie C, plus the famous Sydney fireworks, audio described on the ABC Listen app.
Happy New Year!
On ABC TV and iView and the ABC Listen app.
On air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And on our text line 0438 922 936, Ray Country, hi Tony, Dave in Loon River. G'day Dave. Thanks to you, the ABC Rural Team and Richard Bailey for a comprehensively informative and interesting year. Best wishes for 2026. Kind regards, Dave. Thank you, Dave. All the best to you and your family too. Hope you have an enjoyable 2026. Now, Tasmania has led the way with virtual fencing and collars, mainly on dairy farms. But the other states are now following that lead. Adam Turner has been amongst the first farmers in New South Wales to get virtual fencing collars on his cattle after the technology was legalised earlier this month. He spoke to Amelia Bernasconi about how long it took to teach the cattle, which are beef cattle, by the way, about their new fenceless boundary.
It was actually a hell of a lot smoother than what I thought. Like, I had to duck out in the morning, so I missed out on the first sort of bit, probably half the herd nearly. When they were collaring them. So the guys from Holter come out and gave us a hand to collar up the first lot. So, yeah, when I got back, they were in a pretty good swing and got them all on pretty smoothly. And then, yeah, we walked them across the paddock, set up like a training paddock. So we just had in a smaller paddock, a temporary electric fence set up outside of their virtual fence. And then, yeah, we've just been doing that every day for sort of a week, I suppose, 5-6 days. And not last night, the night before, we took that temporary fence down and had it on fully virtual fence. So, yeah, wow. Going pretty good.
How big is the mob? What sort of, like, what types of cattle are we talking here? Did they push the boundaries at all?
There's 70 cows and calves in this mob. And, yeah, there's one in there that she seems to just want to do what she wants to do. we keep seeing one number that's outside the fence. She stays close, but she's going out picking that better feed outside the fence. And what happens there is, like, it'll give her a couple of electric pulses to say, come back to the fence. And if she ignores them, then it pauses the collar. And then we can just see if there's one that's consistently causing a problem, like she is. We can just pause her collar, and she's actually a cull heifer. Mm-hmm. So we'll sell her in the new year and get rid of her. But the rest of them have all been playing the game really well.
Because a big part of this is the welfare, obviously. You mentioned the cows and calves, and the calves sort of get a bit of free rein. It's just the mums with the collars?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, so the calves can slip through in front of the cows or behind the cows. We find that they'll go out in front, pick that nicer feed before the cows get a go at it. So I'm thinking, and from people that I've spoken to over in New Zealand, they've seen higher weaning rates because then calves have been able to sneak ahead and get that better feed.
Yeah, right. And you mentioned there that one little problem heifer, you know, they get an audio signal, then they get the pulse. Yeah, tell us about what you saw in terms of the intelligence of your cattle as they learnt these different prompts.
Oh, this is probably what really blew me away was how quick it happened. So like I said, we're setting up a temporary fence just outside their virtual fence, just so they had a visual as well. And I think the first or second day, I let them into a paddock, like into their next paddock. We had a virtual fence set up and I let them in and then went up and set up the temporary fence while they were grazing. So as they were grazing up the paddock, obviously they were hitting the virtual fence before they were getting to me. And I could hear them. I could hear the collars starting to beep as they're getting close, and they were reacting to that beep straight away, turning away, coming back down the paddock or
one of them was walking along it, and she'd sort of sway her neck one side, hear the beeps, and then sway her neck the other way. So like
trying to work out where to go.
Yeah, she knew exactly what was going on. She was playing with it, trying to get as much of the better feed as she could. Yeah, so it was really interesting how quick they'd obviously learnt them sound cues.
Yeah, because I've heard a bit through this conversation that dairy cattle will probably take it up better, but it sounds like, yeah, your beef cattle are just as clever.
Yeah, I think so. And our cows, like, to be fair, that mob there, and that's why we started with them, so it was an easier learning curve, they are moved every day behind electric fence, so they're very much grazed like dairy cattle. So they're used to people going out there, moving them around, having strips of feed rather than whole paddocks. So I think it was probably an easier learning curve for them. But, yeah, I think all the cattle are pretty smart, so I don't think it'll take them long to cotton on to what's going on.
Yeah. So how many more collars have you got on the way? Are you going to do this right across the farm?
Yeah, so we've got another farm that we're rolling it out on in the new year. Mid-January, we'll do another 130 up there.
So it all seems to be going well. Just remind us, Adam, why you've been, you know, so much at the forefront of the virtual fencing movement in New South Wales. What gains do you see it coming back to your property?
I see, in general, more usability of grazing country, like especially on coastal country where you've got a lot of hills and stuff. You can't intensively manage cattle on them hills real easily or at all. So I think it opens up them opportunities where you can start pushing cattle to eat up further into the hills or utilise more of the pasture. So I think that will be a hell of a lot better. And then providing more rest, like I said, we do move our cattle daily. So for us, that's normal. But for a lot of people, they don't, because they just don't have the labour to be able to do that. And by doing that, you know, like a lot of people can double or triple their carrying capacity because they can utilise more pasture, they can provide rest, and then get more resilience in their farming operation. So I think there's a whole lot of benefits there. And then I think there's also a lot of land that is underutilized or not utilized at all because it doesn't have good enough infrastructure, where this will open the gates to be able to, you know, not only graze them areas, but graze them very well.
And what peace of mind does it give you that you can sort of track your cattle much easier? I hope you're getting a bit of time off the farm to put your feet up over the Christmas New Year break. Just having that extra intel in your pocket, what does it do for, I guess, your headspace?
Oh, it's great. Like, we're in the butcher shop, you know, leading up to Christmas. So last night was quite a late night, but I could get on the app before I left. I shifted the cattle's virtual fence. Then by the time I got home, I could check the app, see that they'd all moved through, and then my son could check them this morning. So, you know, previous to that, I would have had to get home that night, grab a torch, go out, move the fence, move the cattle, come back up. Like, it just takes that extra labour out and gives you that bit more flexibility. Like, obviously, we're still always with the cattle, but you don't have to be there at certain times. You can manage them remotely, and then, you know, obviously just monitor them as you're operating.
Yeah.
So, like, that's a big one. And to be able to check the cattle is another thing. Like, I looked there before on the app, and I could see that they were all around the water trough. So I messaged my son and said, can you just make sure they haven't switched that trough off, because they're all rushing that trough. So, I think from a livestock health sort of point of view, I think there's big gains to have there as well. Peace of mind, I suppose.
And Adam, these collars have quite a few good little features, but one of them you've taken a nice little festive spin on. Tell me about the light show that you've had at your place lately.
Yeah, so they've got lights. Like, they've already got the lights capability on the collars because they use that in the dairy industry for mating and heat detection. So they'll light certain colours. I think it's red or green. To show whether they're on heat or off heat or whether they've been mated or not. So they're on the collars, but they don't really use that for beef. So Halter have, they set it up so that they put it on the app. It's like a little reindeer button. You click the reindeer button, it says, when would you like the festive lights, it says. When would you like the festive lights on? So you can select, you know, in 15 minutes or in an hour or whatever you want. Select that, and then the timer counts down, and then you go down the paddock, and the paddock goes from dark to, yeah, flashing lights, and it plays, I think it's Jingle Bells through the app. So you can hear it on the app, but they can't hear it on the collars. Their collars are just flashing. So the whole paddock looks like it's got, yeah, Christmas lights scattered throughout. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, close your eyes. Think of the cows. They can't hear the Jingle Bells, but I can see them dancing to it. Adam Turner from Spring Hill Beef Company near Gresford in the Hunter Valley, sharing there with Amelia Bernasconi what the process was like training his cattle with the virtual fencing collars. Now, those collars are legal in all states and territories right now to put the collars onto cattle. And in southern parts of Australia, the waiting lists for this technology are growing. But like Tasmania, the Northern Territory was one of the first jurisdictions to allow trials of virtual fencing collars way back in 2019. But as Fiona Broom reports, researchers are still trying to find out if the technology can work and be viable on remote cattle stations.
So this is our Gallagher E Shepherd virtual fencing collar. Pretty functional piece of equipment here, very high tech.
Virtual fencing systems are now legal in states and territories right across Australia. But there's one big question that hangs over the north. Will virtual fences work in extensive beef production systems? Livestock scientist Dr. Christy Pearson has been running virtual fencing trials with Brahman cattle at the Katherine Research Station.
It's about 2 kilos. We've got our solar panels. We've got our neckband here with a soft rubber at the top that sits over the top of the neck. And we've got our chains down the side, which give the animal the pulse.
So the collar is just one part of the tech that creates the virtual fence. What are the other elements?
Yeah, so there's 2 collars. The cellular collars are standalone items, and you can basically, if you've got cellular reception where your cows are, you can use the cellular collars and they connect directly to the service provider. If you don't have service where your cows are going to be, then you're going to need to get the LoRa collars, which basically connect to a base station that's within sort of line of sight of the collars. So depending on your country type and your paddock size and how thick, you know, vegetation is, you put up different numbers of towers. The guys at eShepherd map that all out for you. So, yeah, it's a pretty straightforward process. The base stations are really simple to set up. We got it down to about an hour and a half to set up our base stations in the paddock. They're on a 6 metre, I think around 6 metre tripod, and they've just got a gateway, battery, solar panel, and yeah, that's how the collars connect to the gateway. And then our gateways have a Starlink, which is a standalone setup next to the gateway, and they're connected straight through to a Starlink. So that's how we get all our comms through.
You're expanding the research side of this at the Territory Research Stations for 2026, but you've already done a bit of work with these collars. What are some of the challenges that you've found working with these?
Yeah, so we've had a really promising year this year. We've been kind of, I suppose, going in a bit slow in terms of making sure we understand the technology and that, you know, the cattle are happy with it, and they've come back in with no issues. We have had 250 neck bands out this year across 3 different properties. I think some of the challenges for us are going to be getting all the collars out. To actually collar an animal is a little bit more tricky than, you know, doing your standard husbandry procedures. So the volume of collars that you put out is going to impact the amount of effort that you've got to put in. So we can collar 100 head in, you know, a couple of hours, and that's kind of making sure that everything's fitted really well. We have a bit of a process for how we check, you know, how tight the collars are and make sure they're working and all that sort of stuff. So I'm sure that, you know, with more experience there, we can streamline that process further.
Using virtual fences in the Northern Territory, even just a couple of years ago, would have seemed like science fiction. Is it a real possibility now that this could be rolled out at stations in the north?
I've worked with a few different technologies for cattle in the past 10 years, and, you know, some of them are more disappointing than others. This one's done really well. We're really pleased with how it's done what it said it's going to do. It's worked on the cows, which is always a bonus. And it's been amazing, yeah, really, to use, to see how it's been able to be integrated into our production system. So I think it's a really exciting time to be involved with cattle and tech at the moment, and the next 5 to 10 years is really promising. And yeah, I'd watch this space for sure, because it's only going to get better.
What is the prospect for how virtual fencing could change farming systems in the north?
I think everyone is going to have a different idea or objective for how this is going to work for their property. Everyone sort of has, you know, focuses that they're wanting to look at with their cattle, or certain management practices that they're wanting to implement. So the virtual fencing is really versatile, because you can pretty much do anything that you can think of. You can see where all your animals are pretty much all the time in real time. You can move your animals wherever you want, however you want, whenever you want. The flexibility to do that from the comfort of the aircon on the app is, you know, I mean, that's what, you know, we all kind of dream about, isn't it? Moving cattle while you're sitting listening to the Country Hour.
A new research project being led by Charles Darwin University and the CSIRO will test whether virtual fences can be effective if cows, but not their calves, are collared. CDU Associate Professor Dr. Beth Penrose says the differences between regional farming systems will be put under the microscope.
So virtual fencing is used a lot in southern Australian systems and in New Zealand, particularly in dairy systems and in more intensive beef systems. It's a bit different here because the size of the property is just so massive. We have a lot more set stocking. We put our cows out and then we might not see them for 6 to 12 months. And so that makes quite a lot of difference, but also provides us with these amazing opportunities to be able to control grazing better over these massive paddocks. Most people's paddocks are very, very large, you know, 1,000 to 2,000 hectares, something like that, which down south might be the entire property or maybe even bigger than the entire property. And so it's giving us this amazing opportunity to be able to manage grazing better in these really extensive systems. So this project will be looking at what happens when you collar the cow in terms of, does the cow respect the fence still, even though her calf might be over the fence? Does the calf respect the fence at all? Do they know from their mums, oh, actually, don't go in there? What happens in terms of behaviour and welfare? So does it really distress either the cow or the calf and therefore may be a bit problematic for using it long term? We just don't have any idea about any of that stuff. No one's really ever done it. That's what we're looking at, because these are the really important questions that we need to be able to answer if we're going to do that on a large scale in the north, because that's most of our systems.
Is it something that you could see being used right across a station, or is it more likely virtual fencing is used for moving cattle in particular areas or for protecting particular areas?
I think there's nothing particularly stopping anybody apart from money from doing it on the whole station, potentially. It's just much more difficult to do over very large areas, and to collar, you know, 20 to 80,000 cows is a lot of animals. And so probably in the first instance to use it on particular areas where you really want to keep them out of somewhere or you really want to keep them in somewhere, and then see what happens. I also see some massive potential co-benefits. So say you're doing it for, you know, the protection of a river system or a water course or whatever. Yeah, that's one use of it, and that might really help protect that area for either biodiversity or for water quality or whatever you're trying to do. But also, you know where your cattle are. So when you are mustering with a helicopter, the helicopter pilot can have that on their phone, can know exactly where the cows are, and that's a bit of a game changer, if I'm honest.
Where's the drive coming from to look into the viability of a virtual fencing system in the north?
I think virtual fencing has been talked about a lot in northern beef in general. People have been quite sceptical about it for quite a while, and that's fair enough. There's certainly past iterations of the technology were not suited to the north. I think we're getting there. But producers now, when you talk about it, are really excited about it. I think often if they think that researchers think it's probably going to be all right, then they can have a little bit more confidence. Although I have to say, you know, very understandably and very wisely, they're looking to see what happens.
That's Dr. Christy Pearson at the Katherine Research Station speaking to Fiona Broom. You also heard from Dr. Beth Penrose from Charles Darwin University talking about virtual fencing and whether that technology can be viable on the big remote cattle stations. What are you having on your New Year's meal for this evening? Well, it's backed by Maggie Beer and researchers alike, so why don't we eat more offal? Made up of animal organs and high in iron and other essential nutrients, experts believe the benefits of offal have been overlooked. Claudia Sullivan has the story.
It might seem unappetizing or even gross to some, but experts say shoppers looking for a nutritious boost in their diet should consider offal. One Australian who fondly remembers offal-based meals like sheep's brain fry is celebrity chef and health advocate Maggie Beer.
I grew up eating offal as a child as my favourite food, except for tripe. The pleasure of tripe happened much later in life. But it was the first thing I ever cooked was offal. It was chicken livers. But we, as a family, we would have brains and sweetbreads and liver. Lamb's fry was such a special treat. And heart even. So, yes, I've been an offal person for way back. One of the great things is brains. I had a Pheasant Farm restaurant, and it was a game restaurant, but for entrees, I would use a lot of offal and a lot of vegetable dishes. But when I had brains on, they would sell out. I'd never have enough to satisfy the day's choice from the customers, usually men who loved it, but their wives wouldn't cook it. So they're so easy to cook. And from a recipe point of view, is poaching the brains and then letting them chilled and then cooking them in nut brown butter with capers and parsley and a good squeeze of lemon. And that, to me, is one of the great dishes of the world.
I mean, the earliest memory you talked about, do you remember the first time you ate it?
Well, I remember the first time I cooked it, rather, and ate, and I know that stuck in my memory because I know I was pan-frying chicken livers. I was 7, and my father said, "Stop picking at those. There'll be none left for anyone else." So that's my first real memory of offal. But we used to also, we would have brawn and pig's ears, you know, anything. It was a total respecting of an animal by using every part of an animal.
Australia exported 234,000 tonnes of edible offal in 2024, according to Meat and Livestock Australia. And even in Rockhampton, Australia's beef capital, there are still loyal consumers of sheep's brain. Bill Douglas is a local butcher, and he works long days to procure their mostly locally sourced products, including animal organ meat.
We sold it mostly to elderly people. Obviously, because they grew up with it, it's something they're still looking for and remember. They come in just for it. If we don't have it, we've ran out, we make sure we have it later on in the week for them and they'll come back for it. It's getting harder and harder to get less places actually selling it. A few young people get the liver because they want the iron. So we have had a few people get the lamb's fry because of the high iron content.
Veterinarian and Australian National University Honorary Professor Robin Alders has been researching food and nutrition security for over 30 years. With almost no research conducted in Australia, she believes the potential of offal is often undervalued.
For earlier generations, the consumption of organ meat was very common. If you think about traditional recipes like steak and kidney pie, and it's still regularly used in more resource-limited settings. So our diet has drifted, we're consuming a lot of junk food, and we're eating only the muscle. So that gives us a certain range of nutrients. But if you then look at products such as kidney, liver, heart, or the brain, each of those have a particular profile and they're often very high in key vitamins, minerals, and the good fatty acids. We live in a world where there's an increasing percentage of people who are malnourished. Let's take, for instance, women of reproductive age. What data tells us in Australia is that around 25% of pregnant women in Australia are anemic. And in many cases, this anemia is caused due to iron deficiency anemia. So organ foods such as liver, very high in iron. And the important thing is that the iron in animal source food, in liver, is what we call bioavailable. So it's in a form that the body can use immediately, which means you get good uptake and good utilization. And one of the problems is that even globally, if you look at the Food and Agricultural Organization, the data that gets submitted from countries focuses on muscle. And it's something that they are actively trying to change right now so that organ meats are also reported, because everyone's aware now that our system is hemorrhaging nutrients if we're not taking organ meat into account.
That's veterinarian and Australian National University Honorary Professor Robin Alders, ending that report by Claudia Sullivan on attitudes towards offal or animal organ meat in Australia. Don't mind the old lamb's fry and bacon, or I can remember as a kid eating tongue and brains as well. Didn't go so much on the tripe. But, you know, people eat pate and they don't even think that, what they're eating is liver. Anyway, whatever you're eating on your New Year's Eve dinner tonight, enjoy and have a great New Year's Eve and a fantastic 2026, whatever you're doing, wherever you are. And we'll be back tomorrow with another Country Hour after midday.